This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Over about the past decade, roughly 1,900 homicides were committed in St. Louis. Of that number, more than 1,000 cases remain unsolved. St. Louis Public Radio, APM reports, and the Marshall Project undertook a multi-year, multi-part investigation that shows that while there's been an improvement in the number of solved cases in the last 2 years, St. Louis police have failed to clear many homicides. And shoddy detective work, lack of resources, and eroding community trust are the main reasons behind that. You'll be hearing about this story throughout the week on St. Louis Public Radio. And now, joining us are two of the journalists who worked on today's lead story. They are STLPR City Politics and Criminal Justice reporter Rachel Lippman and Tom Scheck, Deputy Managing Editor of Investigations for APM Reports. Rachel and Tom, welcome to the program.
It is good to finally be here.
Yeah, hey there. How's it going?
Well, the two of you share a byline with Alicia Santo and Jennifer Liu on today's lead story. You started working on this in 2020. Rachel, what is it that went into this work?
There was a lawsuit. There was data crunching. There were a lot of open records requests. There were a lot of interviews. There were a lot of reaching out to experts. It was just, you know, 4 years of grinding through what it takes to do an investigative story. It was kind of eye-opening to be like, this is a big project that we are tackling.
Right. And Tom, for your part, is there anything that Rachel has missed that deserves coverage in that?
Well, I would say, not to mention, we coordinated among three newsrooms with people from all over the country. Jen Liu, who's on the byline, she's in Los Angeles, and one of our editors is in Vermont, so that was a big part of it. And then also just trying to reach out to the police and try to talk to police as many folk, many times as we could. And sometimes they were cooperative. They talked to us earlier on in the investigation, but later on they just went silent when we really wanted to talk about our findings.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the people that you did get to talk with is Donita Stunson, and she's one of the central people in this story. Donita lives near Huntsville, Alabama, and is the mother of Dominique Lewis. Dominique was shot and killed in St. Louis in 2017. Rachel, can you tell us more about this specific killing?
This was a triple homicide that happened in North St. Louis on John Avenue, which is in the Fairground neighborhood, just a few days before Christmas. The three victims, Dominique Lewis, her close friend and roommate Reba Moore, and a third young woman, Shanice White, they were found in a vehicle outside the apartment that Reba and Dominique shared, and they had all been shot multiple times. Mm-hmm. And there has been no arrest made in this case yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, Donita Stunson talked about the impact of her daughter's death, that impact on the family.
I've always told them, in the natural realm of things, you bury your parents. You bury your parents. They don't bury you. And I've always told them, when I'm gone, all you all have is each other. If you don't take care of each other, you're failing. And I kind of hate I said that, because they have taken it hard.
Tom, how is it that the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department handled the investigation of the murder of Dominique Lewis, along with the two others who were killed in that shooting?
Yeah, we've been calling these murders the 4240 John murders. And detectives really did pursue this with a full court press at first. You know, they put out calls for help. They asked the community for tips. The nonprofit group Crime Stoppers put out a reward, and then they were putting out Facebook and social media messages over time. But over time, like we've seen with many and many of these cases over the years, the case just went cold. And, you know, family members have just been left wondering what's next with this, or wondering when they're going to hear mm-hmm. any update whatsoever.
And speaking of cold, Tom, how important are the immediate hours and days following a shooting in terms of any progress being made with an investigation?
Oh, it's extremely critical. Everyone we talk to say, you know, people are engaged. Police know how to find witnesses, run down potential tips, and other leads. And the suspects are also in the geographic area. Witnesses are there. But over time, As time goes by, witnesses vanish, suspects sometimes move to other geographic regions. Mm-hmm. And this is the most interesting statistic, one of the most interesting statistics that we found. Of the homicides committed between 2020 and 2023, half of the closed cases were resolved within 15 days of the incident.
Mm.
And then 75% were wrapped up in a little over 2 months.
Okay.
So after 2 months, if you don't have an arrest by then or it's not been solved, the likelihood that you're going to clear a case goes way down.
Right. So there is a reason that The First 48 is a show that talks about homicide investigations.
Right. Now, so at least that part.
What we see from here is that, you know, it goes a little bit longer than 48 hours in terms of, you know, being able to successfully clear or solve a case. But yes, time is critical when it comes to these investigations.
Mm-hmm. Now, Detective Craig Robertson was the detective assigned to Lewis's case. Here's what Dominique's mother, Danita Stenson, had to say about the investigation.
What investigation? I feel like nothing was done. I stayed there long enough to get the funeral arrangements done. In that time, I did not speak to a detective. They did not come to the house. They sent the chaplain. He came. And I believe the reason the chaplain came because he was a friend of the family's.
Now, further, Danita said trying to get in contact with the police department was a big problem.
The first year, I called constantly. I must say I called maybe 20 times during the first year after she passed on. And I probably talked to the detective one time, and I know I've left messages at least 4 times. Actually get a voice. I've come to this point that I probably call once a year now. I feel like they don't care.
Is it hard to call?
It's hard to call. It's hard to call.
Why?
Because I'm calling knowing I'm not going to get nothing. I already know. It's like, I probably need to call and let them know I'm still interested, but I know they don't give a damn, so why am I calling?
Rachel, we hear Danita Stenson say she felt like nothing was done. In general, what is it that we know about how the police department investigates homicides?
So physical evidence, things like ballistics, fingerprints, blood, cameras, video, that can help. But contrary to what we see on CSI or other television shows, it's not all about the physical evidence. Experts and former detectives have told me numerous times that most homicide cases require people to talk. But in general, what will happen is a patrol officer is going to respond to the scene, because obviously you don't know what's a homicide until somebody gets there.
Mm-hmm.
Those officers call their supervisors, who are then the ones that will call for homicide to be dispatched to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's also important to keep in mind is in the city, a lot of times you can have multiple homicides in a night. So you are spreading these detectives and these officers pretty thin when you go to respond to a call.
Mm-hmm. So, Tom, I mean, one of the takeaways from the reporting investigation is that there are so many unsolved homicides in St. Louis because of a lack of trust between police and community, not even withstanding sort of the capacity issues. In what ways does that lack of trust show up?
Well, you could hear it in Danita's voice, right? I mean, she was just completely exasperated with this. And when she talks to other community members, there's a frustration there. And that frustration, especially among the Black community, after Ferguson and George Floyd, has just eroded. And, you know, police repeatedly tell us over and over again that they need witness cooperation to make arrests, and yet the community doesn't trust that that's going to happen. Now, that creates even a bigger problem when, as we see, there's more than 1,000 unsolved homicides over the last 10 years. And so folks are worried that if they talk to police, what could happen is that they could be harmed if a suspect is convinced that someone did talk to police, they could be in danger. And then there's this other issue where there's this almost cycle of violence, where if the community doesn't think, or a family member or a loved one doesn't think that someone's going to solve, the police are going to solve the case, they may take retaliation in their own hands. And that what that does is that creates even this further cycle of violence, because what they do is go out, and we found examples of this, where they take an initiative and then try to commit a homicide themselves.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, when you spoke with Danita, did you feel any hint of that lack of trust, or was she wanting to talk with you because she has not seen any progress on the investigation.
So I want to correct something here real quick. It was Alicia Santo from the Marshall Project who did this interview.
Great.
So we're relying on the reporting there. Danita talks in the interview that she did that, you know, she believes and understands in the need for a strong police presence. It's not that she doesn't trust the police in terms of sharing information with them.
Mm-hmm.
She just doesn't trust that the police department is going
to do
their job.
Mm-hmm.
She's, like Tom said, fed up, exasperated. And
yeah.
We talked to a lot of family members and even a lot of experts who say that it just makes these communities where this violence is concentrated, where, you know, they already feel undervalued or devalued by the police and in some ways the rest of society. And when the police aren't doing their basic job of solving crimes, mm-hmm. it contributes further to that feeling of being devalued. And like Tom said, just continuously sets up the cycle of not wanting to talk to the police and then wanting to take justice into their own hands.
Right. Something that I want to make sure we get to. Tom, you know, you'd mentioned some examples of when there are people who take matters into their own hands. And then there are those cases in which witnesses who talk to police, they face very real danger. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, sure. We found two instances here over the last several years where we had one. There was one witness who said that he was willing to talk to police, and testify in a case. And what ended up happening was there started to be some intimidation over the time period.
Mm-hmm.
And that time period, things increased. The young man was he was threatened. His mom was threatened, and eventually that individual was killed. And that was a big concern because the mom kept repeatedly asking police for help, for witness protection, and that never materialized. I should note that the police declined to comment on that issue when we asked them about it in terms of the James Scales case. And then there was another issue where a young man was killed, I think it was about a few years ago, and what ended up happening was his cousin came up to St. Louis from Georgia and
some
ended
kind
up
of relative,
shooting somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was his cousin, I think, and he ended up coming up and took action in his own hands, and then that individual was arrested for committing the murder for the individual that they believed was the suspect in that case.
And we definitely know of at least one other for sure case as we were doing research where the victim in that case had been a sort of suspect in another murder. And when the person was arrested for that murder, he was like, oh, yeah, it was in retaliation for the killing of so-and-so.
Right.
So the idea that there is retaliatory violence for both suspect and witness mm-hmm. is real.
Right. And Rachel, when it comes to the lack of trust between police and community, that has played out in the case of Dominique Lewis, right?
That's correct. So in a Facebook video of a vigil for the three victims of the 4240 John killings in 2018, Detective Robertson does tell the crowd who's gathered that, you know, people just don't want to talk because they are afraid of the police or they are afraid of talking to the police. So there's that community aspect of trust. So, yeah, it did play out in that. They think there are people out there who know what happened and they can't get them to talk to the community.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the co-reporters on the story, whom you just mentioned, Alicia Santo, with the Marshall Project, had talked with Danita and asked Danita a poignant question. Let's listen.
Did you have hope it would be solved, or was there a moment you lost hope about it being solved?
I lost hope right around the time Danielle got in trouble. And I say that because police contacted me more about her than they did about Dominique.
Wow.
And I told the policeman, I said, well, you know what, had you all did what you should have done, she might not have gotten to this point, but don't worry about her. She's going to pay whatever due needs to be paid, but I'm not going to let y'all throw her away.
So, Rachel, we just heard the name Danielle. Tell us who Danielle is and how this relates to everything that you and Tom have been talking about insofar as lack of trust that something's going to be done and taking matters into their own hands.
Danielle Lewis is Dominique Lewis's younger sister and is the youngest of Donita's four children. And Danielle and Dominique were very, very close. Donita says several times they were, you know, each other's best friends. And the night of the shooting, Danielle had been supposed to sleep over at Dominique's apartment. So she felt in her mind, Danielle, that she bore some blame for this because she wasn't there to protect her sister. And she also believed that people knew things that they weren't telling the police, that they weren't coming forward with the information. So after another vigil in 2018, she was aware that some of these people were going to be there, pulled up in a car alongside of them on the highway or alongside the, these people, and fired into the car. No one was injured. Danielle ended up spending about 4.5 years in prison for charges, including first-degree assault.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller, Ron from Ferguson. Ron, go ahead.
Yes. I think the main thing is to make the public aware. These statistics need to be published and updated on a weekly basis. We need to know how many cases are pending, how many homicides are still open, and maybe even the progress of them. But if it takes 4 years to dig this up, it tells me that they're not updating this on a regular basis. And I think they need to start offering more cash rewards and more support for people in the witness protection programs. People don't necessarily have a distrust against the police. They just don't trust the process is fully capable of protecting them.
Ron, thank you so much for calling. Tom, as you're hearing what Ron has just said, what is it that stands out to you?
Well, I think there's a lot of there's a clamoring out there for this kind of information. And I will tell you that we had to sue the department to get it on an individual basis. And it took a long time and a lot of resources to get the information out there. The police will give you general statistics. But when you really try to boil down things down into individuals, it's really hard to do. The second thing is that this is an issue in terms of the lack of trust that has been going on for years. And it's really difficult. The new police chief, Robert Tracy's talking about trying to get into the community and talk, but it is going to take a lot of time. A lot of experts say it takes years and years to try to regain the trust that is gone. And quite frankly, it's going to take a lot of arrests and clearances for that trust to be regained.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the point to make about the cash rewards is $15,000 enough to protect you? You know, as
right.
He mentioned, may need more resources for witness protection, you know, but when you're laying the calculation of, do I want to move to get out of this? Do I want to? There's a lot of calculation that goes on for these witnesses that we don't even think about. Is $15,000 enough to protect me? If I go into witness protection, what am I giving up here? What are even the resources available?
Mm-hmm. Tom, you know, you'd mentioned earlier that police were communicating early on in the investigation. Rachel, why do you think that they stopped being communicative?
I don't know. I think they felt that we've already given you the answers to some of these questions. What more could you have found? You know, that is something that you'll have to ask the police department as
right.
to why they decided not to respond to our requests for comment.
Mm-hmm. No, Tom,
family yeah. members do say, though, that, you know, that we just have nothing to add. And so what they feel is the victim's family members tell us is, well, if there's nothing to add, why should we continue to call back up
mm-hmm.
and, you know, make these calls to just say no news here.
Right.
Yep.
Only to hear what they don't want to hear.
Well,
right,
but
right.
we've had family members say that even if there is no new information, at least just an indication that you are still paying attention and still aware of our case and have not forgotten this case would be acceptable to them. They,
mm-hmm.
It's not that they want answers necessarily. Of course, they do want answers, but they just want to feel that the department has not forgotten about their loved one, that their loved one is still on their radar.
Right.
And that is, of course, difficult when you have 150, 200, 250 new killings a year that detectives are attempting to solve on top of the ones they haven't been able to solve from the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it does matter to these family members.
Right, because we're not talking just about numbers. We're talking about people.
Correct. Each of these are individual people who have loved ones and friends and family.
Right. Tom, one of the other key findings in this reporting investigation is the disparity in terms of whose killings are solved. What is it that you can tell us about that?
Yeah, so out of the more than 1,000 homicides that have been unsolved since over the last 10 years, the vast, vast majority are Black victims. That's the first key thing. The second thing is that we found when we really analyzed the data that since 2010, statistically, police are solving fewer Black cases than whites. And that wasn't always the case. Between 2004 and 2010, they were about the same in terms of statistically solves, but then it changed dramatically over time. And many of the reasons the experts tell us is what we talked about, lack of community trust, lack of witness cooperation, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
And there is definitely a feeling within the community when you talk to them that the Black community, especially, or other communities of color, that detectives just don't want to put as many resources into the killing of, you know, a young Black man as opposed to a young white woman or a young white man, for mm-hmm. example.
And, I mean, what role does blaming victims play in this?
I want to be very careful about it, calling it victim blaming, mm-hmm. but there is definitely a perception when you talk to families that, you know, the police give off a vibe of, well, what was he doing? Why did he get killed? This was in his life. You know, he or she must have done something to be shot, that mm-hmm. it's not random in certain communities.
Right. Tom, staffing is something that you mentioned earlier, and we do hear from time to time about those low staffing levels for the police department. To what extent do police resources play into, you know, the disparity that exists and how many cases go cold?
It's a huge issue. And you could talk to detectives and they feel like they're, if you just look at 2020 when there were, you know, more than 260 homicides, they were just triaging cases here and there. And, you know, victims' family members tell us, hey, what ends up happening is they're like, oh, well, we're carrying a lot of cases right now when they talk to police. The other thing that pops in here is also that as these caseloads go up, there's less attention that's being made to each one over time. And I'll give you another example. I was talking to Scott Abishan, who was a former commander of the Homicide Division. And he said, you know, a detective came up to me a few years ago and said, we really need to crack this cell phone to get a good sense of who the suspect is. I think it could lead to an arrest. And so he said, yeah, go do it. And so they ended up having to pay a couple $100 to crack the cell phone. And what ended up happening is he got a bill for several $100s and he had to justify paying it to his supervisors. And he's like, I don't have a budget here. How am I going to do this? And he went around and around. And finally, one of his commanders in a separate division finally just paid it because they felt sorry for him.
Right.
That was an exact quote that he said. So in these instances, it's just incredibly frustrating because he felt like, I don't have the money or resources to do the work that I need to mm-hmm. do.
So both material and human resources are lacking.
Yeah.
As we wrap here, I mean, there has been more success with clearing cases in the last 2 years. Rachel, what do you attribute that to?
I think part of it is there are just fewer cases in the grand scheme of things. There are still a lot of people being killed in the city of St. Louis, but there are just fewer cases that these detectives are having to take on.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Lippman is STLPR City Politics and Criminal Justice Reporter, and Tom Scheck is Deputy Managing Editor of Investigations for APM Reports. Tom and Rachel, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Happy to do it.
Thank you.
You'll hear more stories throughout this week about this multi-part investigation from St. Louis Public Radio, APM Reports, and the Marshall Project. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get an overview of the 2024 Illinois legislative session, what passed, what didn't, and what's likely to come up during the veto session this fall. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
This episode was produced by Elaine Shaw and our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air?
suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.